RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.
I'm with the designer Thomas Heatherwick, who literally burst onto the design scene in 1997 with a spectacular window display for the department store Harvey Nichols in London. It dispensed with the predictable notion of simply dressing windows. Instead, Heatherwick unified the entire facade with a three-dimensional organic sculptural piece that literally appeared to puncture through the panes of glass to embrace passers-by. And since that early piece, Thomas Heatherwick has continued to surprise and delight the public with an array of memorable projects, from the gigantic 56-metre-high sculpture Bee of the Bang, with its dramatic spikes reaching far out into the night sky of Manchester, to the beautiful undulating shape made from glass beads that hangs in the atrium of the Wellcome Trust headquarters in London. Today, he runs a studio of 40 people ranging from model makers, architects and engineers who work with him on a variety of projects, both large and small, from around the world. I joined Thomas Heatherwick at his home in North London. Thomas, you've literally just come back from Hong Kong, where I know that you're in the process of masterminding the reconfiguration of a 1 million square foot shopping mall, which is a far cry from producing a spiral zipped handbag. I mean, the contrast couldn't be greater. So it would seem to me that a 1 million square foot shopping mall is a bit of a daunting task. How's it going? What's been going on there? What are you actually going to do? Have you got any plans for it yet?
Well, my interest is trying to make extraordinary projects happen, because I trained at a time when there were books full of amazing ideas that architects and designers had, and actually very little of it was ever happening. And there were world famous designers, architects particularly, who'd never built anything. And so I put great importance on trying to make projects happen. And whether that's something on the smallest scale or on the largest scale. And this bag idea was something that, an idea that came up quite a while ago. And whenever I got paid for something else, I'd put some money into trying to make another prototype or experiment. And it gradually, we got closer to something that might work as a product. But the project in Hong Kong, meanwhile, in a way is, it's like everything the studio's ever done in the last 12 years joined together into one thing and then doubled and doubled again. I mean, it's like a working on a... My father was in the Marines and he was on an aircraft carrier. He sort of described how the aircraft carrier is like its own whole town.
Yeah.
And this project in Hong Kong has four skyscrapers sitting on it, and with their concrete columns piercing through this giant podium object that's 20 years old and was built when Dallas and Dynasty were on television and the 1980s were in full swing, yeah. and people wore shoulder pads,
yeah.
and the buildings kind of got shoulder pads in effect. And but it was also a time when daylight wasn't so important in public spaces, and the quality of there wasn't so much competition in public spaces were like, and also a more retail environment. And funnily enough, this is one of the most public spaces. Hong Kong's so hot,
yeah.
that you need to be in air-conditioned spaces for many months of the year. And yeah. so places like this are where you go and people take their first ever boyfriend or girlfriend and wander around and spend time together. So it's enormously public.
Yeah.
And so but it's kind of like a surgery where you've got to keep the patient alive while changing their hearts and lungs and things. It's really interesting intellectually trying to juggle all these things. So I've there's a focus and attention that's happened over the last year while working on the sort of 25 projects within it. One of the best bits of the project will actually be the toilet door hinge. We've invented a new way of making this toilet door hinge. So on the largest scale, there's gigantic new bridges and aspects to it, but actually the interesting thing is, in a way, it's like working on the handbag at the same time as space planning on a large scale. So that's what's always interested me about architecture, in that there's a scale where it's contributing to a city, but then there's also a scale which is just as important as a piece of furniture or an earring or a piece of jewellery, and these different scales that you interact with something.
And so what's the timeline for this project? I mean, when...
It'll probably take about 3.5 years from now to complete. So
we're... And are you the principal visionary involved with this?
We're the lead designer, yes.
You are. And so you will be bringing in other designers to work on it?
We've actually got the original architects who built the project, who know the building back to front.
And so are acting.
No, they're acting as our executive architects for permission side, and we've got the original engineer who worked on it. So you have to be very careful with what you say. You can't just say it's rubbish, because then you find you're treading on someone's toes, and it's.
So are you playing any sort of, signature piece in there? Something that's particularly dramatic or unusual, or are you seeing it as a sort of?
Well, I'm sort of interested in how the whole building is famous within Hong Kong, and I'm keen to try and integrate specialness within it rather than something being separate from that. But there are enormous possibilities within it for focused specialness within. Defined functions that would give value to a developer who has to justify value to their shareholders.
Sure.
But there's quite a visionary man leading this company, and he actually built it originally.
Yeah.
And he's standing back and asking to reinvent what he built 20 years ago, which is quite an extraordinary thing, to be able to have your baby that you made your name on and be able to also stand back from it and reconceive it.
Yeah, and the relationship is going well, and you're happy so far with
it's going very well. Yeah,
that's good.
So we're
okay. Well,
in the thick of things. Yeah.
The thing I wanted to ask you, which is this thing that you've been dubbed, in fact, by Terence Conran as a Leonardo figure. And I'm sure you've heard that before. How does that make you feel?
Well, it's very nice of Terence to say that. I mean, Terence has supported the studio enormously from when I was actually a student and met him for the first time, and so he's biased.
I think you made it probably, didn't you, for his garden?
At the time I was at the Royal College of Art, and the Royal College of Art is in a far too valuable a place to build a college where people are going to have space to really think freely and experiment. It's the piece of real estate's worth far too much, so things are very squashed, and so a workshop in which you might build something is tiny, really, relative to what you can do. And so at that time I actually had an idea for a new way of making display cabinets and books, and Terence came into the college, and I managed to sort of grab him in a corridor somewhere, and asked him if there was any way I could speak to him for 5 minutes, because I was interested not just in what my design was. You know, everyone was just there obsessed with their own design, but I was interested in its relationship to why someone else might want it, or how someone objective would look at it, and therefore what its real value was in a marketplace. And he said, well, come and see me at Butler's Wharf. And so I went to see him for 5 minutes and ended up being there for about 4 hours. And one of the things I showed him was this idea for a way of making a small building.
Yeah.
And he was so kind and just said, well, why don't you come and live at my house for 4 months to build it? And so I lived in Berkshire on the most with space, yes. Use it with the work, with this fantastic furniture workshop that's there, living there, eating off these really nice wooden plates that they had and I actually fell asleep on in front of Terence on one of the first times in a dinner or something, and just collapsed because we were working so hard on this. And then in the end, he actually bought the structure
which I've seen in his one of his many books on the garden book in particular. They're very nice, and it looks like a beautiful building. And it's in wood, and it's what is it?
It's made from birch plywood.
That's right. Yes.
And it's an experiment. It was just a very big experiment.
Yeah.
It was an experiment in making. Could you make something that might loosely be called architecture?
Yeah.
Out of only two components, because I was sort of there thinking, why are buildings often so fussy and fiddly, and why are they conceived in this sort of what felt to me quite formulaic way?
Yeah.
And so this was, it's more like two piles. I think I'd been making something else actually, and made these pile of components. I'd been looking at the pile of components and looking at what I was going to do with them, and looking at them thinking, well, actually the pile was more interesting than what I was supposed to be doing with the pile. And that evolved into saying, well, if you had if you piled these pieces, quite hard to do when I'm gesturing over the place here. But I was interested in the idea of a building being made of almost like a pile of cards.
Yeah.
That if you parallelogram it over, it's across on itself, it would want to fall over.
Yeah.
But if you get two piles, you can shuffle them into each other and they'll structurally hold themselves up.
Yeah.
So this building really was an experiment in using only two components which were cut out of big sheets of plywood and just piled up, turned into a building. So I wasn't designing doorknobs or window catches or walls, ceilings. So it was these components kind of made everything. It's quite a simple thing, but it was... I sort of believe very much in making the real thing as much as you can as your experiment, and not confining things to models that are there sweetly, cutely representing what the real world could be like.
Actually,
if only that frustrating real world out there would come and grab you.
Well, actually, funnily enough, as an aside, what you just said strikes a note in me, because as a kid, I always loved the concept cars. The concept cars were always brilliant, and the real cars are always boring. And it's still like that. You know, you see concept cars, and you think, well, why do they not make them now? What I'm told is that the marketing people get involved, and they iron out all of the kind of innovation, and end up with these rather bland cars.
Yeah.
That's what does it. Because, you know, I know from the faculty, when you see car designers work, and you see their concept work, it's fantastic.
Mm.
Anyway, what I wanted to go on to now, before we get off onto those sort of territories, is I want to get an insight into your early life, okay? And I know that your mother was a bead expert, is a bead expert. Your father was a musician. Your grandmother was a textile designer for Marks and Spencer's, and your grandfather was a writer on engineering innovations. So that strikes me as being the most fantastic backdrop for a potentially creative child.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to, I'd like to know how that sort of manifested itself in you. It would seem to me that you were very much sort of nurtured by that group of people. Would you?
I was very lucky to be supported in what I was interested in, and I think, and my father was also very interested in child development, so I think we were like little guinea pigs for him.
Yeah.
And I think that I always drew and enjoyed drawing and was quite good at drawing, so that was a good sort of starting point.
Was that one of your sort of, I mean, what were you like academically as a child? Did you err towards the drawing and the visual side, or was
it feels very predictable. I wish I could say I was academically I was very interested in mathematics actually, but and really enjoyed maths, but I wasn't by any means a kind of gifted mathematician.
Yeah.
I've always been quite quite practical and really wanting to understand a very sort of gut level things, basic level. And for me, when maths turned into very pure and sort of took its feet away from practicality, it lost all interest for me. So I was, I got A for maths and things like that, but it then suddenly got to a thing and I wasn't interested in it anymore.
But you were always, as a child, you were very quickly, it seemed to me, got interested in making things, making different. I know that, for example, you made various greetings cards and so forth, and they became increasingly inventive. And I know that that love of greetings cards carries on with your annual Christmas card that you produce at Heatherwick Studio with your little...
That's just because I'm a prisoner of making cards now. It's a vicious circle.
Because you know that designers always are prisoners of making cards, because I think most designers can usually draw, and if they're in jobs that are not creative, as certainly in my case I was, you always get asked to draw the birthday cards and the cards of people, and then we do become prisoners. But you seem to, I mean, certainly the cards I've seen that you've produced, I mean, the ones when you were a very young Thomas Heatherwick, were, you were interested in folding and sort of concertinas and die cutting and flaps and all sorts of things, which seems quite interesting for a very small boy, and they were very contained, it seemed to me, quite small.
Well, I've been interested in inventions and I sort of things that do things that things that are interesting to me, and so I've always liked what things do and why they do them, and not just the two-dimensional image. I've been interested really, I suppose, in function, way things work, and so the cards that I was experimenting with were, I was trying to, I suppose, do things I couldn't see that were available at that time. There weren't three-dimensional cards particularly that did many things, so I was there experimenting with making a card that made it like a toaster, that the pieces of toast that came up had writing on them. I'm cheesy, it sounds really cheesy now when I say it, but I enjoyed figuring out how these things could work. And at the same time, I was there trying to think about, you know, how could you make a sledge be more comfortable? Could you make a pneumatic sledge? And the value of ideas was kind of growing. And certainly, I think my grandfather had been very interested in, because he'd been born just at the end of the Victorian era, when there was this explosion of innovation and inventiveness and courage at doing it, really making extraordinary bridges, steam power, all these different kinds of forms of power that would, and people like Brunel had been there just doing really incredible things.
And you would go off with your grandfather to see pumping stations and things like that. Is that right?
Because that's what tickled him and really interested him.
And
the mining and things like that. So I found that brilliant. So much more interesting than football or rugby or cricket or anything like that.
What about your father and music? Did that have an effect?
Well, I think for my father, my grandmother was a servant at Windsor Castle, and then she moved to Newmarket, and she sort of lived in quite a sort of small world really. And music for him was this way to discover an artist, this world of artistic thinking.
Right. Okay.
He was very gifted as a musician, and won one of the national prizes for a pianist when he was just 14, and that meant that he was being taught from then on by really good teachers. And those teachers, they might be teaching the piano, but they suddenly were able to throw a world into him that sort of really expanded him. And then when he joined the Marines, that was another way. He was in the band and the musical side. So you were meeting really extraordinary people because of the music, this music link. So yeah. He got very interested in the design of clothes, all sorts of things. And so as a child, if you're in tow of someone who's genuinely got a real interest in...
Yeah.
What are those sculptures? What are those music? What kind of car is that? And what? So the design council at that point had a public face.
I know.
And so we would go
on
Haymarket. It was wonderful. And so my father and I would go into
the tail end of it.
Sadly,
because it ran right through the 60s and 50s and 60s and I think into the 70s, and then I think it closed.
I think even into the 80s, actually. I think it was there for quite a lot of the 80s, and then it got sort of lost its public face. But for me, that was something sort of leapt when I went in there, and at the different times, and saw the different exhibitions that were just on, free,
and they
just
were free,
accessible.
And I think that's the thing that's really lacking, because now, we have museums that are free, but I think to have a design resource centre like that free, where you can go and see the latest design innovations, whether it be it furniture, whatever it might be, electrical goods or white goods. And they had a, if I remember rightly, in the basement, they had a directory where you could go and literally look up all the designers, and it would tell you all. And it seemed to be a great idea. Great pity. Anyway, this leads me on to the fact that, so I can see that you were, inspired by the people around you, your parents and your grandparents, and you went off to study 3D design at Manchester Polytechnic. How did college life suit you? How did you find that? You moved away from home, I guess.
Yeah, I had a fantastic time at Manchester because I was able to, in a way, when you're at school, you're kind of a prisoner. Your time is decided by everyone else. But when you're finally, you don't have to do any subject because someone says you should. You're really, it's a manifestation of your interest. That's why you're there. It's purely. So my life just suddenly leapt forward when I finished school into being able to be. It was 100% about what really interested me.
So you were very self-disciplined,
so driven. I've wanted to be a designer since I was tiny. So I feel it's very boring. There's not been any moment of kind of, change of direction or any choice. There's not been, it's just been a line forward. So when I was at Manchester, there were some really good people and we spurred each other on. There was a kind of competitiveness that was, because when you're around people who are really onto something,
absolutely,
that really spurred things on.
See, that's the ante. It always does.
And interestingly, I found that more at Manchester than at the Royal College. I think there are different times that different. So I felt much more on my own and at the Royal College. Yes, but. While at Manchester, it was possible to really take ideas, and I think the tutors who were there were interested to expand what a course called three-dimensional design could be. And so when I wanted to build a building, there was a bit of hilarity, but then they really got behind it, and we found a man who would help with sponsorship, who's in a department with no one asking him to help them, and so he got about £20,000 worth of materials to build this building, and then all the students in the year below decided they'd help me to do it, and we got our own workshop. So I spent a year building a building there that was. And there was an engineer who was a tutor who'd worked. So I worked at his house at the weekends to engineer this. And so there was a kind of interesting, kind of real, for me, flourishing of an interest and being supported in that.
Yeah, that sounds tremendous. It sounds interesting. You just mentioned that you would spend weekends at your tutor's house makes a direct connection back with Terence Conran. It seems that you befriend people and your enthusiasm perhaps infects them, and suddenly you've been sort of adopted by them for a short while to work on projects.
Well, I think maybe it's that way, or the other way round, in that I sort of found there's something very cold when you're there as students lined up in rows and their desks supposed to be doing something good.
Yeah.
And I found things sort of came alive when I was working with people.
Yeah.
And so I've clung on to people around me who and sort of made groupings to make things happen.
Yes.
And because I can't do them by myself, and they need many people's brains, and so they are that other person's project as well as my own, and so that's what things like colleges, I think, it can be quite poor at doing, because it's very much up to the students' initiative to figure out their way handling
that's
things.
That's interesting, because I think in design quite often, and I'm in a different area of design than you are, but I've noticed myself over the years that often designers tend to be silo thinking. They want to keep everything to themselves, almost like at school when you didn't want anyone to copy you. You put your arm around your work. Mm. And I feel sometimes designers do that for whatever reason, and it's to do sometimes with wanting to be credited for something, and it's jealousies and all of that sort of thing. But the fact of the matter is, the moment you share an idea with somebody who is also creative, it expands the whole thing. And usually good comes out of it if you can be that generous, seems to me. And I think that, you know, more people collaborating or brainstorming or whatever, just,
One way to see it is if it's really generous.
Yes.
Another way to see it is that without that, you won't get what you want out of it anyway.
Yes.
So it's, in a funny kind of way, it's selfish to share.
Yeah.
If that makes sense, because it was out of pure necessity that I found, and pleasure, you know, and my pleasure was that we had in by clinging desperately to people around it, something actually turned into something more interesting for all of us somehow or other.
I think the interesting thing about you is that you term yourself simply as a 3D designer or a three-dimensional designer. You don't categorize yourself in any other way. 3D design is sort of very wide. And that seems to me to be a very good idea because, for example, you know, there are one or two design engineers within the faculty who are trying single-handedly to raise the profile of the engineer, who is often submerged under the egos of architects, and often their contribution is, you know, absolutely amazing in terms of not only the structure but the look of things. They have but often, you know, it's the architect that's right up there and the engineer gets, but you seem to have very cleverly cut right through that by not really applying yourself to any of those names.
Mm-hmm.
Was that an intentional thing, or it's just
no, really it wasn't. I thought about studying architecture, but at that time, architecture was something that I think now it's in a different place than it was 20 years ago. It was very cerebral and quite cold, and in terms of architects being the makers of the biggest objects that are around, and therefore utterly makers. At that time I was there, and the courses that were available were being taught by no one who'd ever made anything, and teaching young 18-year-olds to be intellectuals, rather than, to my mind, the interesting thing, you didn't need to design a little whirring machine or abstract form of poetry. The interesting thing was to design a building. That wasn't base. That wasn't the interesting thing was how you could design a building to have these special qualities. And it seemed almost scared to design real buildings. And so I think now it's in a very different position, but so I've swerved away from that. So I sort of felt that there was such a connection between the smallest things and the largest things, and the kinds of ideas that you might have for a small thing that may influence thinking on a large scale and vice versa. So I went for this middle, that something that I really like, that the course in Manchester was called three-dimensional design. Mm. That to me is my specialisation, yes. And I'm a specialist.
Which covers on one area. A broad spectrum.
But it's it not. I don't do sound, and I don't do flat things.
No.
So, and I don't. You know, I don't feel that I've. It wasn't a kind of. It's not a.
It's kind of. A
it's genuine. It's,
really.
It's just genuine. It's a genuine. It's genuine yeah. response to, and expression of what I'm interested in doing, and the studio has evolved to have people who are from, I suppose, have done more specialised courses.
Yeah.
But we all this work in this area, which for me feels quite specialised. But
I mentioned in the introduction to this programme a project that I think certainly singled you out as special, and that was the Harvey Nichols window display, for which you, at the time I remember, won a DNAD Gold Award, which was quite a coup. And the display itself was phenomenal. I mean, I'd never seen anything like it. I don't think anyone else had. That seemed to introduce what, to a certain extent, has become not a hallmark, but a passion, which is a sort of undulating and organic shapes, which seem to reoccur in your work, or you seem to have a fascination for. Can you just tell me a little bit more about that kind of fluidity of thinking? I've noticed that I saw in the documentary program you produced this very interesting, I think it's a sausage skin, which it was like a magician's series of silk handkerchiefs that you just keep pulling it out. You seem to have a take on things, unusual things, that you automatically seem to see the possibility in them and transfer them to another place. Is that how?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Harvey Nichols thing particularly was, I mean, the shapes were bizarre, I felt at the time. Mm. It was a bizarre event, so dramatic that it was like it had arrived from another planet. For me, anyway,
I think that, I mean, I feel that the projects that we've worked on in the studio are, for me, I can justify everything about them logically. The project at Harvey Nichols started from, I suppose, a self-consciousness. I feel I'm very self-conscious. I'm very interested in context and, I suppose, of myself within any context with people, as well as things in their context and in the context of time as well. And I remember being interested to hear that someone saying that give me any object from any time, I can date it within 5 years or so, because the fashions for things are so strong.
Yeah.
And you can think that you're doing something out of your time, but actually it slots so easily in. I think there are very few people, maybe Gaudi did things certainly at the time, that jumped forward out from their time. But there were two things with that particular project at Harvey Nichols. I just was aware, having seen many window displays, that you'd go past a building and, oh, look, the windows, oh, that's interesting. There's Noddy, or there's Airfix kits, and suddenly the whole, all the windows of a shop, whether it's Selfridges or Harvey Nichols, have got something interesting in them. Obviously, the brief is be interesting, to draw attention to the building, but it seemed to be, literally, you could pick anything you like, anything possibly, the more bizarre, anything, just pick it, and stick it in the glass, and you'd stick it there. You know, toothpicks, just toothpicks, and poof, there it is. But the Harvey Nichols was there. Instead of 12 windows, in a way they're like 12 display cabinets or whatever. And one way to think of it was that this is a collection of little gallery windows, and you can kind of put a little display in each one. Mm. But there was also this classic thing that no one looks up at buildings, and there's actually this pretty spectacular building. And normally the shop windows, what's down there, has nothing to do with quite historic, fantastic facades of a building. And that building has all these brick columns coming down. So one thing is to see them as glass windows, and the other is to see instead a building with all these fingers coming down, touching the ground. And thought, what would be much? How could we do something that really relates to that building, rather than just being any old thing and pick off the top of our head, because fashion loves anything funky, kind of interesting or different. So thought, instead of having 12 things, have one thing that weaves through the entire building and up the facade. Felt like it was really literally engaging and knitting in to that building and going where you're not supposed to go. You expect things to be in a nice, well-behaved way behind the glass.
Yeah.
And that premise of one thing weaving through the entire building meant that you both came out of the glass and in. And so there was, I suppose, there was a dynamism to that. And in terms of the Harvey Nichols brief, which is to draw attention to themselves, just thought, well,
certainly
technically something going where you wouldn't expect it to, whether you like it or not, would. But then in terms of the actual shapes, it was very possible to do just almost like a snake just going in and out, and that would have fitted the original budget.
Yeah.
But that just felt too easy. It felt like too obvious to just, because then all you'd be appreciating was, oh yes, they've gone out and in.
Yeah.
And it felt that there was this other layer, and I'm sort of interested in how many layers of specialness you can give. I mean, maybe it's greed, or I just want to make something as special as it possibly can be. So, that led on to all those shape, the form.
Exactly. Well, what I wanted to go on to, because I think that that those early projects may have informed what you later went on to do, and I'm thinking now of the Kagoshima Temple. And I think the story, I'd like you to tell the story, the inspiration of that piece, because I think it's such a lovely story anyway. Your meeting with the priest, and I think you stayed with him for a while, certainly in his temple. So perhaps you could just tell us how that extraordinary building came about.
Well, I went to Japan and was introduced to the priest and his project managers, and we... there was this big moment of them deciding if they were going to commission us or not, and we spoke about many things. And then there was a moment really when I started talking about making things, and I didn't realise what, but suddenly there was this moment where they all looked at each other, and you suddenly realised something had changed in the meeting, and you suddenly realised the body language, suddenly they'd decided, okay, please come up with a design. So... there was this, it was the most enormous responsibility to be asked to design a temple as someone who isn't Japanese or Buddhist or has ever built a temple before. And so the weight on my shoulders felt just enormous. We went to Kyoto and we spent a few days there and they showed us all the temples. And my heart was there thinking, oh no, they just want us to copy these temples. And then there was a moment where they said, we want you to understand these, but we don't want you to copy these. And the pressure was on, you know, enormously. And then the form, it was hard because they're so modern in their thinking. They wanted a temple that would have car parking spaces in it, and they wanted a building that would have an automated retrieval system like a jukebox with the cremated remains of people inside it. And it's these things to wrestle with about, but it would also need, with the current health and safety regulations, fire escape staircases, all these conventional things in architecture, which all the original temples didn't need to think about. And so I had to kind of close down the studio virtually and just close its doors down, or stop doing anything else, not go out, not leave the place. It just felt so much responsibility, which I think is the best possible thing anyone can do for a designer. And so the first two, I said that I would like 4 months to do this, and I'd like you to not contact us, which no one's ever said yes to that, because clients are always a little bit jumpy and they want to, could you just maybe you could send me a sketch. Could we just see a sketch? Because I'd hate you to waste your time. And that mentality that wants to check you're okay and check that. But they agreed to not. So we had this intensive time, and I stayed with him in his porter cabin with his plastic portaloo on the site that looks out at a volcano. And so spent the first 2 months trying to work out how to put the spaces together, and then began really how should it really feel, and how, what will the form be, and how can this really sit into the site and this very steep piece of land. And it actually, the form in the end that came about from looking at fabric and the wonderful religious fabrics that the priest wears, these thick, very manly and yet very feminine fabrics. They're so butch, but beautiful at the same time. And I was very keen to try and pull together all these strange things that a building needs, and not break it up into here's the emergency escape staircase, here's the main temple space, into a composition. I didn't want it to become what architecture so often becomes, is a sort of delicate composition of geometrical components or interesting shape components, but to make it one cohesive whole. And fabric allowed this possibility and stopped me over designing it. It let the fabric almost designed it sculpturally for one. And so then the studio is based in King's Cross, around the corner from the Royal Nose Throat Near Hospital, and they have this 3D scanner for scanning faces, particularly of children, before and after operations. And we worked with them, and they scanned our big fabric models that we were making in the workshop, and that enabled us to work digitally at a very high level with how the building functioning and building construction could work. So it was a very interesting project from different angles.
And it is the most wonderful building. And that takes me on to the Blythe Jeeson project at the Wellcome Foundation headquarters, which if anyone listening to this to this program hasn't seen, they really should go if you're in the vicinity of London, because it is, I think, one of the most beautiful pieces of work. And I think this is where you kind of blur the boundaries between, if you like, design and, in quotes, fine art, because I see that every bit as a piece of sculptural art. And I know that with your other project, the big project, the Bee of the Bang up in Manchester, there at the time there was, I think, a little bit of tension about, is this person an artist? And you were compared with Gormley and his Angel of the North and so on. And there was this, I mean, that's back to labelling again. And that seems, for someone like you, very irritating, I would think, you know, that these little arguments go on around, you know, is this person an artist? Should it have gone to a sculptor? I mean, what do you feel about that? Because I think that the Blythe Jeeson project, and I love the serendipity, which I'd like to tell the story about how that name came about. Mm. I mean, first of all, I think we should describe it. This is in the atrium of the Wellcome Foundation. It consists of 150,000 glass spheres, and it is then suspended on 27,000 wires spanning 30 metres in height, which is phenomenal. And I know that that your mother's expertise in beads, and as a child you were aware of her bead curtain, and there was a kind of link there, which I think is charming. But I think that the lovely part of this story is how the title came about.
The name came about because the form, we'd been experimenting to try and find, we had quite a tight brief for the project. There was a pool of water, very tall, high space, and the idea of making a big sculptural object that could go there, but you couldn't get anything into the building because there was no big doors. So we got irritated and almost thought, well, we'll just design something that comes through the letterbox of this building. So that sort of broke it down into making small components. rather than big components, door-shaped components. And then the thing, in terms of the form itself, because there was a pool of water built into the building to have a sculpture above it, we didn't want to just put anything above a pool of water, because that seemed a cliched idea of what sculptures should be above and what they're like in buildings. So we thought, well, what's that water that's down there like? If you drop it, what do liquids do? And because I'd seen some amazing footage of the forms of liquids as they fall, and thought, well, in a way that'll be more interesting than anything I'm going to make. Any form I'm going to make is probably not going to be as interesting as just liquid falling. So in the end, we found the best way to capture that. We tried all sorts of experiments, but was by pouring molten metal into water. And in a fraction of a second, you get this absolutely incredible shapes. They're tiny, about 50 millimeters high. So we did literally hundreds and hundreds and picked the one that fitted this building and sort of worked with the programming of the building, the bridges, the different levels, made a sort of variety and worked sculpturally as well as physically, and made it 30 meters high rather than 50 millimeters high. So
yes.
It scaled the scale up, and used a laser scanner. But then when my grandmother came to the studio, she said, "What is this project you're one to work on? What's this?" Because she's always interested in what we work on. And she's worked for the last 30 years as an art therapist in Germany after she finished working at Marks & Spencer's.
Yeah.
And she just suddenly said, "Well, this is Bleigießen." I'm like, "What? This weird sort of almost ugly sounding word." And she said, "This is Eastern European tradition. Every Christmas, for New Year, you pour molten lead into water, and the shapes you get, you put on your palm and you read them, you interpret them."
How amazing.
To tell you about the future, your future that year. And it seemed very appropriate in totally post-rationalised way that the project we'd intuited and designed felt right for that building, which was a new building, which is for the future of the Wellcome Trust, this biomedical research charity, that its future was going to be defined by what's also used for telling the future in Europe, in the eastern part of Europe. So it was just sort of, that was totally jammy coincidence. But so that word, we couldn't really avoid that word. It seemed appropriate to the project. So
I love those serendipitous things. We're just going to come forward now towards the end. Another building, which I'd be very interested to know at what stage this building is at. I saw images of what I think is being termed as the kebab building. Can you tell me a bit about that?
We've been commissioned by a developer to look at making a taller scale building, and it's kind of in development at the moment, and it's the site at the moment is still confidential, but it's on the site of a tube station, and it's relatively close to the M1, and so it's actually certainly when I went to Manchester in my little car, you'd come back to London, and this, when you've been driving for 4 hours, your first impressions of London is quite what constitutes London as people from the north of England drive in. Those first buildings are quite, you're looking for, am I there yet? Am I there yet? Am I nearly there finally? And so this building, a taller building, meant it's going to be one of the main things you see as you come into London. And so I was very aware that this was an opportunity to not only mark a part of a quite rundown part of London, and not only to, as information, let people in the area know where the tube station is that currently is quite hard to find, but it also had this other job, three-dimensionally, as a sort of little signpost representing London. So in an otherwise quite low-rise area. So this sort of evolved into looking at the idea of tall buildings, and having spent a bit of time in Hong Kong recently and looking in the Far East and seeing tall buildings and tall buildings really splendidly tall, and the trend of how they almost look like you've gone to Woolworths and you've got get 20, get 10 free, you know, this pile just piling up and piling up, just these sort of thrusting vertical towers, was I was interested in how could we make a tall building that maybe was not slightly less of the obvious male boy's fantasy thrusting thing with all its associations, and was there some way to sort of soften what a taller building might be, and this step of making it actually three buildings rather than one building, and but using the lift and staircase through as a core, almost like a skewer through. And so it sort of evolved into, I suppose, quite a North London thing, which is like a shish kebab, literally, of these three buildings. But they've evolved in that way because that gives them the possibility to have many balconies, which has been part of the brief, to allow gardens and which are built into the building rather than just sort of sterile vertical residential blocks that actually look very similar to office towers and leave me quite cold. So we've been trying to look at affordable ways to make building cladding and to make this to work. So it's been a very exciting thing to work on.
I think on the kebab building, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much, Thomas Heatherwick.
Thank you, Mike.